This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with an attorney about the FBI's non-indictment of Hillary Clinton.
I'm shocked, just shocked.
We'll take a look at what really happened to Chelsea Manning last week.
Of all the truth tellers, she is a true heroine. They picked her up, tortured her, tried her, imprisoned her for 35 years, and now they won't even let her attorneys get through on the telephone to find out what her health situation is.
A recent federal court decision involving the FBI's takeover of a child pornography website has yielded a very bad decision on personal privacy on home computers.
It goes to show the old adage, bad cases make bad law.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. FBI Director James Comey announced at a press conference last week that the FBI had concluded its investigation into Hillary Clinton's use of her personal email account for State Department business, and that he would recommend no criminal charges against her. Comey said that Clinton's use of a private email address and server while she was Secretary of State was, quote, extremely careless. The investigation found that she had sent 8 top-secret documents through a hackable email account, and that it was possible hostile foreign governments could have gained access. In order to warrant a criminal indictment, there had to be evidence that Clinton intentionally transmitted or willfully mishandled classified information. Joining us to comment on this development is First Amendment attorney Carrie Shankman. He worked with Michael Ratner on the Julian Assange case and continues to work as Assange's attorney. Carrie Shankman, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me, Heidi.
Carrie, what did Hillary Clinton do?
So I want to start by saying that the phrase Hillary Clinton email scandal has been all over the news, but I think in many ways that's kind of a misstatement of what this is about. I don't think it's an email scandal at all. It's a public records scandal, and that really goes to the heart of this issue because that's what's not being reported. But in terms of what Clinton did, in her tenure as Secretary of State, she used multiple private email servers, not just one email server, but the FBI found she had multiple email servers over several years on which she sent and received official emails, many of which the FBI found were classified. In fact, over 100 classified, several top secret, secret, and then over 2,000 were later classified after the fact. And what the press has focused on has been the classification of these emails. So, for instance, Rand Paul recently wrote a piece in Time where he said that Clinton was reckless and should be prosecuted because she put American national security at risk. And a lot of the press has been focusing on national security. But I think that really misses the issue, mostly because classification in and of itself is not a measure of national security. That's just accepting the CIA or some agency's determination that something should be classified rather than posing any genuine or immediate risk to American or any lives. But instead, as I said earlier, what is at stake is a public records issue. Clinton set up a private email server in order to avoid accountability under public freedom of information laws. Her emails are public records. They belong to the American people. And the American people have a right under law to access those under the Federal Freedom of Information Act. In fact, this is something that she was aware of. And there was a story in TechDirt just some time ago that one of her emails showed her in 2010 writing to her aide, Huma Abedin, saying, let's get separate address or device, but I don't want any risk of the personal being accessible. And that was Hillary Clinton who said that in 2010 to her aide.
But let me interrupt. What's wrong with saying she didn't want personal emails available to the public? Don't officials have a right to keep those separate?
Well, it was clear that Clinton was conducting official business on these accounts. And her public line was that she was using, that these were personal devices, that she just wanted to be able to access for convenience emails on a personal device. But the facts don't support that. And the FBI inquiry does not support that. In fact, she was sending emails related to Honduras, related to Ukraine, related to her policies, and as I mentioned, classified information. So it doesn't support that these were personal emails. She wanted to keep all her government emails away from public scrutiny, away from public oversight.
Isn't it true that she lied repeatedly about what she did?
That's absolutely true. And this is something that, disappointingly, the FBI inquiry failed to really account for. But Hillary Clinton publicly lied about the use of her emails. She lied saying that the practice of using a private server was allowed, when in fact the State Department's own oversight body, the Inspector General, said that she failed to comply with the State Department policies on records. And actually, the watchdog said, quote, they found no evidence that the secretary requested or obtained guidance or approval to conduct official business via a personal email account on her private server. That catches Clinton in a bold-faced lie, because she said in several interviews that practice was allowed.
I just want to add, I read in an article called A Guide to Clinton's Email that Colin Powell actually used a personal email account for government business from 2001 to 2005, but others had not. Was Powell ever called to task for that, to your knowledge?
Well, I think a key difference is the concurrent use of those emails, and that it's something that was continued in Clinton's tenure, and also the fact that when she was brought to scrutiny about it, that she consistently lied about it. I don't doubt that many public officials use personal email accounts in order to avoid freedom of information laws. In fact, a federal court ruled just yesterday, I believe, that private email accounts are open to freedom of information lawsuits, that those records are available for public scrutiny, because just having a private account doesn't change the fact that they're public records. If a government employee takes a file box of public records home, just the fact that they're housed at home doesn't change the fact that the public has a right to see them.
Attorney Carrie Shankman, do you believe that what Hillary Clinton did, what FBI Director James Comey described last week at his press conference about what she did, do you believe that any of that was indictable?
While FBI Director Comey said that, quote, there's evidence that Clinton and her colleagues were extremely careless in their handling of very sensitive, highly classified information. And also he said, quote, any reasonable person in Secretary Clinton's position or in the position of these government employees with whom she is corresponding about these matters should have known that an unclassified system was no place for that conversation. Despite those statements by the FBI director that she was being reckless, I actually do not believe that Clinton should have been prosecuted on national security grounds for the mishandling of classified information. It's well known and documented, actually, across both sides of the political spectrum, that there's rampant overclassification at the federal level, that the director of the NSA has actually said that Christmas cards and birthday cards get marked top secret, and you have numerous government officials, attorney general, saying over the years that classification is essentially a method of getting documents read, that it doesn't represent, as it was intended to, the actual security involved in a document. So, all that being said, I don't think classification alone is a reason for prosecuting. What I do have an issue with is the rampant double standard that the Clinton case exposes.
Yeah. Talk to us about that, because I think that's really crucial, this two-tier system of justice that we have in this country.
So when I say that Clinton shouldn't be prosecuted, I say that to mean that I don't think anyone should be getting prosecuted for these types of offenses. But that's not the reality. Clinton got off for something that someone unimportant would be in prison or in exile for. And this has happened repeatedly over the Obama administration alone. In fact, Obama has prosecuted more truth tellers than all previous presidents combined under a 1917 law called the Espionage Act. And there are many whistleblowers who are in prison. Chelsea Manning, who I know you're going to speak about, hear about more in this segment. Edward Snowden is in exile in Russia. And even non-whistleblowers, individuals who just leak for their own career, like General David Petraeus, who was writing a biography and leaked top secret and code word materials to his mistress and biographer. He was sentenced to 2 years of probation and got essentially a slap on the wrist compared to other truth tellers, but he still actually faced some sort of penalty, which caused a furor at the FBI.
So essentially, government officials are not held to the same standard that the government is using to go after whistleblowers or so-called ordinary citizens who share information.
I wouldn't say government officials. I'd say high-ranking and protected government officials. For instance, you have Thomas Drake, who was actually a very senior NSA official, and he was dragged through an Espionage Act prosecution that ultimately failed because an internal review showed that prosecutors were actually hiding evidence. He was forced to plead guilty to a misdemeanor, but his life was basically ruined because he has to sell his house to fund his legal defense.
So could I amend that to say that government officials who expose information that potentially embarrasses government policies like Drake did are gone after with harsh sentences?
Absolutely. Those who air dirty laundry, those who expose war crimes, cover-ups, abuses of power, they end up in exile or prison. And the worst part is that Hillary Clinton knows exactly what she's doing, because when Chelsea Manning was facing not just life in prison, but possible death penalty for disclosures in the public interest, who was one of the biggest cheerleaders for the prosecution of Manning? It was Clinton herself. And Clinton said during the trial of the court martial of Chelsea Manning, let me add also that nothing that Manning handled was or disclosed was classified top secret. It was all secret or lower, unlike with Hillary Clinton. But here's what Hillary Clinton said. Quote, I think that in an age where so much information is flying through cyberspace, we all have to be aware of the fact that some information which is sensitive, which does affect the security of individuals and relationships, deserves to be protected, and we will continue to take necessary steps to do so.
What Chelsea Manning revealed was evidence of U.S. war crimes in Iraq, including several outright murders that were filmed. I had an observation, Carrie, on the former CIA agent, John Kriaku, I hope that pronouncing that right, who revealed the name of a CIA agent to a journalist. It was never published anywhere. He just told the guy. And he was imprisoned under the Intelligence Agents Act and got a 30-month sentence. And Clinton, in the emails that she sent, also mentioned the name of CIA agents. So I'm not sure that I would agree with you that she shouldn't have been indicted. But let me just ask you to reflect upon this, because then the question becomes, well, what was in those emails? And, you know, 30,000 of them were deleted by her lawyers.
Right.
And they claimed
right.
that they deleted personal stuff.
Right.
Well, we don't know because
they deleted them.
They were deleted, so
right.
we don't know what was in it. But what I'm suspicious about, just like I'm suspicious about what she said to Goldman Sachs in those three speeches that she collected $675,000 for and won't release, what I'm suspicious about is what was in those emails, because I think that as Secretary of State, she perhaps misused her position working with her husband, who was the head of the Clinton Foundation. And there have been allegations in Black Agenda Report that the Clinton Foundation was being used to launder money for extortion, to shake down, for bribes. For example, getting an industrialist in Canada the rights to mine uranium in Asia. And then the Clinton Foundation would get a huge donation for facilitating that. And I suspect that, and having your wife as Secretary of State helps, and I suspect that some of those emails that were deleted have to do with Hillary as Secretary of State and the conflict of interest she had with her husband as head of the Clinton Foundation. What's your reaction to my speculation?
Well, I do agree with those points, and I'm very, very glad you brought up the deletion of those emails, too, because that also exposes Clinton in a huge lie about claiming to be transparent or forthright. In fact, she wasn't open with investigators. She wasn't, I mean, in any other investigation, she would be in serious trouble if lawyers were found deleting the subject of investigation. But to the point of the conflicts of interest, I mean, we saw that just last week with her husband, Bill Clinton, having a clandestine
right.
meeting
with
the Attorney yeah. General, Loretta Lynch, who's overseeing the investigation. And you saw these hoops that they tried to jump through to try to give this some modicum.
We only
of,
talked about our grandchildren.
Yeah. Yeah, some they tried to give it some modicum of legitimacy with Lynch saying she's going to defer to the FBI. The FBI is a fact-finding investigator. They don't make legal claims on decisions to prosecute. I mean, the whole thing was absolutely absurd. And then the Justice Department said they're not going to prosecute. So, I mean, this thing reeks of a conflict of interest. I mean, Bill Clinton is clearly involved in this. No doubt that the Clinton Foundation is involved in, you know, in back alley deals involving Saudi Arabia. I would say I just wanted to flag too on your point earlier about the prosecution of releasing the CIA name. You know, when I said earlier, and don't get me wrong, I don't think John Kiriakou should have been prosecuted. I don't think Hillary should be getting away with anything, but I also don't think we should standardize prosecutions that are going to end up being used against low-level government employees, because that's what's going to happen.
Right.
You know, Heidi, I have an observation about how this all was done, because the FBI works for the Attorney General.
Right.
The FBI is the investigative branch of the Department of Justice, which is headed up by the Attorney General. But last week, we had the FBI calling a press conference and saying she shouldn't be indicted, which precluded the Attorney General from making the decision. So that all, I mean, what do you think about
good
that
point.
That procedure, which is, I understand, unprecedented?
Well, the whole thing is unprecedented from the FBI having a press conference like this. I don't recall any instance of that happening either. I think what we really saw happen is after Clinton met with Loretta Lynch, that precluded Loretta Lynch from issuing a independent decision to prosecute. So she passed the buck over to the FBI. Then the FBI did something unprecedented, which prevented them from making a decision.
Or a recommendation.
A recommendation.
Right.
Which meant that everyone's essentially dropping the ball like a hot potato and...
Yeah.
The case. I mean, it was a political maneuver. Absolutely.
If Clinton was indicted, she would have to take herself out of the presidential race.
Right.
I mean, right now she's carrying around a heavy ball and chain. But if she was indicted, she'd be finished. So that would make Bernie Sanders next up to the plate. And I think there may have been some calculation there about, because Bernie Sanders, according to the polls, would beat Donald Trump in an election. So I think there was some calculation there in terms of whether the powers that be want Bernie Sanders as the president. Because for one thing, he'd cost them a lot of money. They'd prefer Hillary, and they'd certainly prefer Hillary over Trump, who they view as a wild card. And I think it played out just the way they would hope it would play out now. And Hillary will march on to be president.
Well, I think they probably encouraged it to play out this way. That was... by design.
I recommend reading the full statement by FBI Director Comey, which is available on the FBI website. It was also printed by the Wall Street Journal, because it really reads like a political concession. You have an unprecedented statement, but with this language calling her reckless. I mean, it's all so unnecessary. Like, why would they have to go through those hoops admonishing her? Because it was a political trade-off. It said, okay, you get off, but we're going to slap you around for a bit and say that others will be prosecuted. I did want to actually, I don't want to forget this. There's one line I think that really stood out to me is probably one of the most significant part of Comey's statement, but it's one in which he talks about the factors in bringing the choice to bring a prosecution for mishandling of classified information, and he lists many, many elements such as clearful and intentional, willful mishandling. But one point he says is that a factor are indications of disloyalty to the United States, and that is a factor in bringing a prosecution. Indications of disloyalty.
That's huge.
Which strikes me because in my read, and I hope perhaps the listeners agree, because these have to do with public records, and the whole point of Clinton setting up this email server were to keep records away from the public, who was Clinton disloyal to? That was an act of disloyalty to the American people by withholding records that the American people have a right to. But apparently the FBI's calculation is much different, that in fact it is truth-tellers like Chelsea Manning, like Edward Snowden, who bring information to the people of crimes, of cover-ups. That's the real disloyalty, which I think exposes that the idea of loyalty is shutting up, is keeping secrets, is keeping information out of the public view instead of making that available to the people who deserve it.
It's keeping it within the status quo.
Right.
Yeah. Carrie, in our remaining minutes, do you have any final thoughts about what this portends for the future?
I will add that it seems clear that Clinton's going to be able to keep her security clearance, which is absolutely unprecedented. And low-level officials mishandling classified information or downloading information, as happens, and gets prosecuted. They face fines, those individuals, they lose their clearances, and they lose the right to have a clearance for life. But Clinton's not going to just keep her clearance. She's going to get the highest clearance possible, potentially as president of the United States. And also going into an office where she has a horrible track record already of transparency to the American people. Even Obama, who's one of the worst presidents for transparency and with freedom of the press, even Obama made some pretext of being transparent. He said he was going to have the most transparent administration ever. So Clinton's potential presidency does not bode well at all. I represent Julian Assange. Of course, WikiLeaks published a searchable database of Clinton emails, and Clinton has come out publicly condemning Assange, condemning Manning, condemning Snowden, condemning fierce publishers, courageous publishers, and truth tellers. So we're not going to just see her continue to be not transparent, but I imagine engage in a witch hunt against those and keep putting forward this two-tiered justice system, what I call injustice system, that goes after truth tellers and keeps the powerful human rights abusers unaccountable.
Carrie Schenkman, well said, and we really look forward to these updates from you on Julian Assange and a variety of related topics. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Carrie. Imprisoned Chelsea Manning, the Army soldier who, as a truth teller, passed evidence of U.S. war crimes onto WikiLeaks, have expressed fury at the military authorities' handling of her medical status amid a swirl of media speculation that she had attempted suicide. Manning, who is serving a 35-year sentence for leaking secret diplomatic cables and other official documents, has been cut off from contact with her lawyers and all other outside connections for more than 36 hours, causing alarm amongst those closest to her. The sudden severing of contact follows a rash of media reports based on unconfirmed rumors about her medical condition. The Army is refusing to give details about what has happened. Persistent inquiries by The Guardian have produced only a statement from the Department of Defense that said that the soldier was taken to the hospital in the early hours of Tuesday last week and now has been returned to Leavenworth Prison. Our guest, Alexa O'Brien, researches and writes about national security and capital crimes. She has worked for several years on the Chelsea Manning case. Our guest, Alexa O'Brien, researches and writes about national security and capital crimes. Her work has been published on Vice News, The Guardian, Salon, The Daily Beast, and featured on the BBC and on Democracy Now! Alexa O'Brien, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Alexa, you've been very close to this case for years. That's when I first met you, when Michael Ratner was going down to the trial. Tell us, for our listeners in a nutshell, for people who may not be so familiar with what happened to Chelsea, tell us her story, please.
Sure. Michael Ratner was a great supporter of Chelsea Manning. Chelsea Manning is a young U.S. Army intelligence analyst who was responsible for disclosing to WikiLeaks hundreds of thousands of low-level battlefield reports and diplomatic reporting concerning the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as a video of a July 2007 Apache airstrike that killed civilians, including two Reuters journalists in Baghdad, Iraq, and other material. to WikiLeaks, who subsequently published it, and was brought up on 22 charges and convicted on 20, including espionage, and then she was acquitted of aiding the enemy. And she was sentenced to 35 years in prison and is currently incarcerated there at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas.
And we heard last week rumors that she had attempted suicide, was taken to the hospital, then returned to the prison. We understand that her lawyers haven't been able to get through to her. Can you tell us about that, please?
Sure. So on July 5th, TMZ of all outlets reports some pretty distressing and horrible news, rumors essentially that Manning had attempted suicide and was brought to a local hospital near Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, where she's incarcerated. This was followed up in the morning of July 6th with a tweet from a CNN reporter. And then a subsequent confirmation by the Army that she had been brought to the hospital, but they admitted that they couldn't comment on anything because it was illegal. I mean, it would violate privacy laws. What's interesting here is her attorneys were never informed of anything happening, including anything that would rise to the level of an emergency, which is when the brig is responsible for contacting her lawyers. And then when her attorneys attempted to contact her, because they had a scheduled call at 2 p.m. on July 5th, when she was allegedly at the hospital, according to the report, public report from her lawyer, Nancy Hollander, the Army wouldn't allow the call to go through. And now they're not letting Manning's attorneys contact her until Friday morning, which is tomorrow morning. So, you know, to me, this is certainly very distressing for anybody who is concerned or cares about Chelsea Manning. But secondly, it also sort of, in my mind, is pretty much in line with the way the U.S. Army has handled Chelsea Manning's mental health history in an exploitive way.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because it was distressing to us right from the start, the conditions under which she was held when she was imprisoned and the hard time they've given her since then. Could you fill our listeners in on how they treated her since they arrested her?
Well, military prosecutors at her court-martial wanted to cast her as an unstable person to justify their illegal suicide regime when she was in pretrial confinement at the Quantico Brig. And a portion of that time was ruled to be illegal because the brig had kept her on suicide watch against the recommendations of the brig's own psychiatrists and doctors, who said she wasn't suicidal, that in fact suicide risk was exacerbating her anxious state. And so on suicide watch at Quantico during her pretrial confinement, she was forced to strip naked. She was held in quasi-solitary confinement. And like I said, a portion of that was considered to be illegal. The only reason why the other portion of her time at Quantico was not considered illegal is because the brig had a right, according to their own rules, to keep her on prevention of injury watch, despite whatever the doctor said, because they considered her to be a threat to herself. But this whole regiment was based in previous mistreatment of her for her issue. See, what most people don't know is that Manning was diagnosed with gender dysmorphia prior to her arrest by a U.S.
What is that, Alexa?
Manning is trans. She was assigned male at birth, but she identifies as a woman, something that the Pentagon now admits exists and is a part of our society, and they've, in fact, made it currently, just recently, legal for trans people to serve in the military. You know, it's funny because Manning's in the Army, and when she was sent into pretrial confinement, she was sent to a Marine Corps brig. At the time, the Pentagon, including the Secretary of Defense, were cognizant, very cognizant, of the fact that their review, which was, you know, concurrent to her confinement, showed that the Marine Corps had a higher rate of homophobia than any other branch in the U.S. military. And the Marine Corps brig, Quantico, was also built for AWOL temporary detainees who were facing court-martials because they basically skipped town. Manning was held, like, in max conditions and chains, you know, with these prevention of injury watch and suicide. And, you know, what's funny is that the Marine Corps justified it because she had one actual suicide attempt in Quantico after the U.S. Army segregated her because she told people that she was gay. So they segregated her in a cage and, you know, kept her on this crazy sleep cycle. She was also, you know, this is right when she was arrested, that she had one nervous breakdown. And they used that whole regimen to justify their treatment of her throughout her year and a half confinement prior to her court-martial.
And then they sentenced her to 35 years. Under what kind of conditions is she serving that time?
Well, up until between May 2010 and April 2011, she was held in Quantico in solitary confinement, and under prevention of injury and at times suicide watch, which required her to talk to a guard every 5 minutes to say that she was okay.
Oh, no.
It was awful. And then after public outcry, she was moved to Fort Leavenworth, where she's currently incarcerated, and she was removed from max custody to medium custody, which is what she's at right now. You know, it's interesting, during the court-martial, the U.S. Army spokesperson would insist that Manning was suicidal throughout the proceedings to the press. And when an Australian journalist once asked the Army, why do we not have a public docket that tells us what the case law is or what the rulings are in this case, which is what you expect in a federal court. And the public affairs officer would respond, well, because she was suicidal and we're trying to protect her. I mean, it was ridiculous. Even to the point, and I'll just stress this and then I'll stop talking, is she, her medical records, the prosecution insisted that her medical records be published publicly when we didn't even have a docket that said what she was, or an official charge sheet, interpretations, the government interpretations of aiding the enemy, espionage, and all these things that would have an effect not only on Manning, but on the greater public.
Do you think that the government's treatment of her has been kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy on this suicide, or what do you think is the situation? Do you have any idea, or is it just speculation?
I don't know what happened, and the public doesn't know what happened at Fort Leavenworth, why she was brought to the hospital. But what's interesting to me is that the U.S. Army uses these regimens and these protocols and leaking things inappropriately to the press, and have throughout this entire ordeal, to try to cast her as unstable, when in fact the Manning I see in the courtroom, or saw in the courtroom, is not unstable. She has a genuine medical condition and requires treatment for it, you know, like you would for depression or like you would for anxiety. I'm not suggesting that I know Manning is depressed or anxious. I'm just saying that she has a medical condition that the U.S. Army diagnosed her with prior to her arrest, and that it requires medical treatment. But they've exploited it and mistreated her, which is unfortunate, because here you have a defendant and a convicted offender who has treated the U.S. Army with nothing but respect publicly, despite all that she's been through, despite her entire court-martial, and she's only spoken well of the people that she's been around. She always tries to treat people with respect. The U.S. Army can't seem to treat her with the kind of respect that she has a right to and that she deserves.
So what can listeners sympathetic to Chelsea Manning do to support her?
Well, I think for one thing, they can certainly support her defense fund. She's currently, you know, mounted a challenge to her conviction, her unfair conviction. I mean, no one, and Carrie could probably speak to this, but no one has had, you know, a sentence like this for the crimes that she committed. I mean, she was sentenced like worse than a child predator. And she actually leaked really documents that were viewed by, they were not closely held documents. I mean, these were documents reviewed by at least a million government contractors. So this is somebody who certainly didn't intend to harm the United States, has been respectful throughout this entire process, wanted to inform the public, because she trusted that the public had the, you know, if they reviewed these documents and knew these things, they could make wiser policy decisions. And for this, she's been essentially treated incredibly poorly, but also the government is trying to cast her off as a very unstable person. And I think they're doing it because they know that they don't have the ethical or the legal ground. So they have to basically malign her in the press.
It's been revealed by James Comey, the director of the FBI, last week at his press conference on why he did not recommend the indictment of Hillary Clinton. But he said that she had transmitted over her own private email, which was open to hackers, 8 top secret documents. How does that compare to what Chelsea Manning was sentenced to prison for?
I think, in my own opinion, it's 100 billion times worse, and I'll tell you exactly why. Because Hillary Clinton is the Secretary of State. The kinds of cables that Manning released to WikiLeaks are Wikipedia compared to the kind of intelligence value of the material of the Secretary of State. Secondly, I'm surprised no one has brought up the idea that Hillary should be considered for the hacking statute that Manning was convicted of, namely the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Now, Manning was convicted to this charge, which held a maximum of 10 years, because she installed a freely available software called Wget on her classified machine. There was, you know, no clear Army regulation against this installation, and certainly, there was a lot of vagueness about whether or not it was allowed or not. And because she wanted to automate downloading things for her work product. We're not even talking about just for disclosure. She actually downloaded large data sets because she worked with the material she leaked. Hillary Clinton built a server to make her life more convenient and her work more convenient. And if Manning is going to be charged with, the CFA and convicted of it for installing a freely available like application from the web, and Hillary Clinton is going to get nada in full violation and willful. I don't understand where the FBI director thinks that Hillary Clinton wasn't acting willfully. I mean, she was in direct violation of the rules that she knew she was not allowed to break regarding operational security, but also specifically the handling of classified material, and finally also the Public Records Act. So there are all these various issues. I think it's just absolutely disgusting that Hillary Clinton didn't even get the, former CIA director Deutsch treatment of having her security clearance publicly pulled, or having, this issue of whether or not this person deserves a security clearance being discussed.
And he was hooked up with a computer for pornography, as I remember. In any case, we've come to the end of our allotted time, Alexa. It's wonderful to have you back on Law and Disorder. Before we let you go, though, will you give us some advice on how we can contact via email the Chelsea Manning defense so we can come to her aid?
Absolutely. The Chelsea Manning Support Network is reachable at chelseamanning.org. And certainly people can follow her on Twitter. It's XYChelsea on Twitter.
Great. Alexa O'Brien, great to have you on Law & Disorder. You take it easy.
You too. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Most of us assume that what we write on our own computers, in our own homes, is completely private. But a recent federal court decision held that criminal defendants have no reasonable expectation of privacy in their personal home computers, and the government doesn't need a warrant to hack into an individual's computer. In 2014, that's exactly what they did. The FBI hacked for over 2 weeks, taking over and operating a child pornography website called Playpen, after a Virginia court issued a warrant to do so. Agents used software that bypassed Playpen users' anonymity, enabling them to be tracked digitally. More than 135 people faced charges. As courts are grappling to apply traditional rules of criminal procedure and constitutional law in these cases, several bad decisions are being made. At the forefront of educating the public about these digital rights is the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who filed an amicus brief in this case. Joining us today is Sophia Cope, staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Previously, she worked at the Newspaper Association of America on freedom of the press and digital media issues, with a focus on protecting journalists' confidential sources. Sophia Cope, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
The facts in the playpen case involve a child pornography site. Tell us briefly about what happened.
Sure. So on Tor, which is a network on the internet that allows folks to be anonymous, there are these websites that can only be accessed through Tor. So they're called hidden websites or hidden services. And through investigative work, the FBI actually was able to seize the server for one of these hidden websites that they believed contained child pornography. And they actually kept it running because they wanted to see who was logging into this website. And so they were basically trying to find these people who were logging in with, you know, anonymous credentials, so that way they could, of course, track them down and ultimately apprehend them to prosecute them.
Judge Henry Koch Morgan, Jr., the federal judge in the Eastern District of Virginia, wrote in his opinion that, quote, hacking is much more prevalent now than it was even 9 years ago, and the rise of computer hacking via the internet has changed the public's reasonable expectations of privacy. React to that statement and tell us what exactly the court held.
Sure. So that statement was really shocking to us at EFF. Really, in this case, there were two issues that the defendant in this case was someone who was tracked down through this basically sting operation and then prosecuted for child pornography. There are really two issues in this case. Whether the government needs a warrant to install malware on your computer. So basically that's what they did, is that folks who were coming to this server that the FBI had seized and had full control of, what the government did is that they obtained a warrant to basically install malware, so send, you know, sort of malicious code out to tens of thousands of users in an effort to try to track these people down and get their exact location. And the defendant, of course, challenged that under the Fourth Amendment. And so the question was, does the government need a warrant to install malware on an individual's computer? And if so, what does that warrant look like? And so the judge said that actually, no, the government, in this case the FBI, does not need a warrant to install malware on your computer. The judge said that internet users, the user computers that are, you know, connected to the internet, with the understanding that hacking by other people, not necessarily the government, right, but hacking by other people, identity thieves, etc., is prevalent on the internet, and therefore people basically assume the risk that when they go online, that their computer is going to be potentially a victim of hacking. And therefore, they have no reasonable expectation of privacy in their personal computers, in their homes, and therefore somehow that justifies the government being able to also hack your computer without a warrant, and it's, therefore it's not a Fourth Amendment violation. And so from our perspective, that's just completely outrageous, because it's like saying that because burglaries are up in your neighborhood, you're living in that neighborhood knowing that, you know, your house could be subject to a burglary, and therefore the government, the FBI, the local police doesn't need a warrant to barge in through your front door and search through all your stuff. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So that was the first issue related to the passage you just read in the opinion. And then the second issue was, if for some reason, you know, this judge concluded, you know, hypothetically, that the government did need a warrant, of course we think they do, then the question was, well, what should the warrant look like? And so, like I said, in this case, the magistrate judge had authorized a warrant literally for tens of thousands of people, because tens of thousands of people were logging into this server that contained some child pornography. Other parts of the server had discussion forums where people were engaging in wholly legal free speech, you know, a wholly legal speech. And the warrant basically was just very, very broad. It was like, anyone who comes to this server and logs in the government can install malware on their computer, and that was literally tens of thousands of people. And so Fourth Amendment law actually says that that's not appropriate, that you really need to be as specific as possible, focusing on a specific user or a specific computer. And so we'd actually submitted an amicus brief in this case, saying that because the FBI had control over the server in particular, they really could have done more investigative work to try to pin down specific users that they suspected of child pornography, and they just didn't do that. They literally just installed malware on everyone to try to kind of, you know, get their location, and then they were doing their investigative work after the fact. But then the judge said the warrant was fine and that the government can use these really, really broad warrants. So those were the two aspects of the opinion that were really, really concerning.
Sophia, let's talk about how this decision affects ordinary Americans in their daily usage of home computers.
Sure. I mean, the bottom line is, and this is what we fight for at EFF as a digital rights organization, is that if you have an unsavory defendant, like an alleged child pornographer, and you have new or unfamiliar technology that the courts are trying to grapple with, you often get bad law created, right? So the judge clearly in this case was bending over backwards to uphold what the FBI was doing to investigate and ultimately prosecute child pornographers, which of course they need to do that. I mean, you know, no one was going to object to the FBI trying to do this, specifically to, you know, to go after child pornographers. But what happens is that you get bad law created, right? So no warrant is needed for the government to hack into your computer. And even if a warrant were needed, it could be a really, really, really broad warrant that could affect tens of thousands of people and basically, you know, allow the government to, you know, engage in this fishing expedition that violates tens of thousands of people's rights. And so, frankly, today's child pornographer or a group of child pornographers could be tomorrow's group of political dissidents. And so once you have bad law on the books that allows for this kind of government overreach, it can be applied to everybody, including people who are engaging in totally innocent activity, or, you know, it might be activity that, like I said, is sort of, you know, maybe politically controversial, but is definitely legal. And, all we have to do is look back to the civil rights movement when the FBI was, surveilling civil rights groups, right? And so I don't think it's a stretch to say that now in the modern age where we have this kind of technology, that if bad law is created with unsavory defendants, that bad law is going to potentially impact the rights of wholly innocent people.
Sophia, talking about bad laws, there were several cases stemming out of this. How many more cases are pending to your knowledge? And have the other decisions been as bad as this one? How does this decision fit in with related ones?
Our understanding is that the FBI is actually pursuing hundreds of prosecutions related to this particular Tor website. But as far as I know, that this is actually the worst decision for those two points, again, that the government doesn't need a warrant to hack into your computer, and that secondarily, if they do, that somehow, you know, a very, very broad warrant that basically allows them to go on a fishing expedition somehow comports with the Fourth Amendment, and we totally disagree with both of those conclusions.
Yeah, well, the old adage, bad cases make bad law, and we certainly got that
right
here. How does this case dovetail in with the body of law on privacy? Is it an exceptional thing, or is it starting to lean that way? Put some perspective on it for us, please.
Sure, and it's a great question. I mean, we really operate at the cutting edge of privacy and technology, and we do see courts struggling with trying to apply existing law to new technology. But as the passage you read from the decision talks about the reasonable expectation of privacy, and that is one way of that the Supreme Court has applied or implemented the Fourth Amendment. So basically you look at whatever the thing is that was searched or seized by the government, and you say, well, did this trigger the Fourth Amendment? And one way courts can analyze that is whether or not a reasonable person, sort of the average reasonable person, would expect to have their things be shielded from arbitrary government interference. And I think it goes without saying that your personal computer, particularly in your own home, to some extent it's sort of irrelevant that's in your home, but the case law has traditionally highly protected the home from government interference. But your own personal computer that you're using for your personal correspondence, and you might have your health information on there, and your financial information, and your personal photos. But I think a reasonable person in today's society would most definitely expect that information would remain private, and that the government should only be able to get at that information by going to a judge, getting a specific warrant, a particularized warrant, based on probable cause. And even though judges do have difficulty sometimes applying existing case law to modern technology, I think in this case it shouldn't have been very difficult. But the judge obviously came out and made a conclusion, or reached a conclusion that we really disagree with.
Sophia, the Electronic Frontier Foundation has wonderful resources about sort of electronic self-defense on its website. Mm-hmm. Do you anticipate, if we continue to have poor decisions along these lines, that you will make new and different recommendations?
Yeah, potentially. We do recommend everything from, using encrypted services, using anonymity services, just being thoughtful about what service you're using based on how sensitive your interaction is, right? So if you're a journalist trying to communicate with a confidential source, you're going to use other services versus if you're someone who's, you're a business person trying to protect trade secrets or something, you might have a different threat model. So really what we try to do is we try to get people to think about, okay, what's the threat model? How sensitive is your information? Where do you anticipate the risks being, or the sort of your adversary, so to speak? Because for some people, it's not the government. For some people, it is actually traditional hackers. So we first ask people to think about, what's the threat model? And then we do offer different both technical tips and sort of just behavioral tips to try to, keep people as safe and secure as possible. But I think this case shows that it can be really difficult. I mean, people do use Tor. So child pornographers unfortunately use Tor, but so do political activists and other people who have legitimate reasons for wanting to remain anonymous. But the government is still finding ways to hack into the Tor network. So it's sort of this cat and mouse game, and it really can be quite challenging.
Sophia, we just have a few minutes remaining, but I wanted to note that you wrote a chapter in the American Bar Association's book, Whistleblowers, Leaks, and the Media, The First Amendment and National Surveillance, topics that we care greatly about on Law and Disorder. You've also worked at the Center for Democracy and Technology on issues related to regulating internet content. Can you give us your thoughts about the future of free speech on the internet generally?
Wow, I could write a treatise on that.
Maybe just a few points for people who don't read and know as much about it as you do. Are we heading in a good direction where we have a free, robust, open internet, or do you see strictures increasingly being placed on our use?
I think perhaps paradoxically a little bit of both. On the one hand, we see just this plethora of new applications and new ways to communicate. Just even looking, not to bring in another difficult subject, but the recent police shootings where folks are pulling out their cell phones and recording, these events on social media, and it's really getting out there and really contributing to the dialogue around this very difficult issue. But on the other hand, both in the United States and in other countries, we are seeing governments becoming more sophisticated and, finding ways to conduct more surveillance, or finding ways to take down content, um, or or just generally discourage people from participating in, you know, free and open speech online. So I would say it's, again, like in the specific playpen cases, it's a little bit of this cat and mouse game where, you know, technologists and people who really value the internet are trying to find new ways for people to engage online as freely as possible, whereas, you know, governments are trying to find ways to, you know, so like I said, surveil people or take down content or whatever. And so, it really is a little bit of both, that that there's great things happening online, and there's lots of different kinds of speech, and lots of great things are happening on the internet and that are facilitated by the internet and digital technology. But you also see governments becoming more sophisticated. And so, you know, what we try to do is that we try to encourage users not only to sort of think about how they can kind of protect themselves specifically, but also we really want people to engage in these policy debates and these legal debates. Because, you know, we like to think that we're doing a good job, but we're just one organization. And really, ultimately, it change really comes and pushback comes from the grassroots. And so we often try to get people to send letters to their congresspeople or to other people in government to really say, look, no, you know, we don't like this policy that you've adopted. We don't like the fact, for example, that the FBI, you know, people could write to their to the attorney general or to the president or to the congresspeople and say, we don't like the fact that you're implementing or trying to take down child pornographers by, you know, using this kind of malware or whatever. So it really comes down to people wanting to be engaged and really fighting to preserve their rights.
Attorney Sophia Cope of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, it's been a real pleasure having you on Law and Disorder. We're running out of our allotted time, but before we do, how do our listeners stay in touch with the EFF?
We have a very simple URL for our webpage. It's just EFF.org, and we have all kinds of resources on there and information. We have a great blog called Deep Links. And we are a membership organization, so we definitely encourage folks to support our work and to sign up for a membership, and that's the best way to stay engaged with what we do.
Sophia, we're all fans here of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and look to you as our first line of digital defense. So thank you so
thank
much
you.
For your fine work.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.